Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and it's been broadcast on Preston, Swindon and St Albans Community Radio. Back soon on BCFM. This week, political science lecturer at Moscow State University and Russia. Today, correspondent Mark Slebeda on Ukraine, 2 years after the coup. Nick Outerside on the backstabbing Scottish Tory Masons. Kevin Boylan on Resonance, this company that's supposedly looking after the homeless in Bristol but making money out of them. And also Steve Lyle, a victim of the Glasgow Council Mafia. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. Call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
All right, Tony, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure and an honor to speak with your listeners. My name, Mark Slebeda. I'm an American citizen. You could say my first career, I was served in the U.S. military for 6 years in the nuclear engineering field. I immigrated to Russia, married a Russian citizen, a Crimean, actually. I'm a little bit, I would say, full disclosure, I do have not an objective opinion. I have a very personal involvement in the conflict in Ukraine, being as my wife is Crimean. We have our mother and father. My mother and father-in-law still live in Simferopol. My sister-in-law used to live in Kiev until she had to flee the city with her child after the Maidan putsch. And we have some family in Donbass, Kharkov, and Odessa, pretty much across eastern Ukraine.
Mark, can you tell us a bit about your sister? Because why would she, anyone
sister-in-law?
Why would she have to actually flee? What was the reason? I mean, most people stayed in Kiev, didn't they?
Actually, quite a lot of people left. She left because she was a teacher of the Russian language to foreigners. She taught Russian as a foreign language. And in her neighborhood, about 3 or 4 weeks after the Maidan putsch happened in 2014, right sector, the neo-fascist paramilitary that was so active both during the Maidan and after, started going around door to door at night, knocking on people's doors and asking them about their loyalty to the new regime, their ethnicity, and their religion. And when she heard that this was making the rounds in her neighborhood, she decided, for safety's sake, but especially considering, her occupation, she fled back to Crimea, where she was born, and brought her child with her, and has, stayed there safe and sound ever since.
You've been in the U.S. military, worked in nuclear engineering or something.
Yes.
You said. Can you tell us what can you actually tell us about what you were doing there?
Oh, it's not very secret. It's a fairly public program. I trained for a couple of years in essentially a military academy, and I operated a nuclear reactor on a warship. Actually, the last U.S. nuclear cruiser. It was decommissioning when I was getting out of the service. But after that, when I immigrated, met my wife in Boston and then immigrated to Russia, obviously I couldn't do nuclear engineering as an occupation in Russia as an American immigrant to Russia. So I went back to school and went and eventually did my postgraduate. We went to London for a few years. And I created my finished my postgraduate degree in international relations and security studies at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And I teach at Moscow State University, the same subjects, and I do a lot of political analysis for media debates and the like.
Tell us about the coup in 2014. I think it was February in In Kiev. And also later in that year, there was another event in Odessa, which was particularly horrific. Can you just take us through events as we now know? Because, you know, what happens, Mark, and I'm sure you're as a journalist, you're just as much aware of this as I am, is we often get 2 or 3 days or weeks of media blitz on these, and then everything goes quiet. But as it goes quiet, lots of other little factoids, drip out, and they never make the news. So what do we now know that we didn't know at the time about both the coup and the Odessa incident?
Okay, well, what we may know about the coup, I think it's what's surprising what we still don't know. But I think definitely some reflection on the events of that are really timely. There was about 3 months of protests, ostensibly. These were over the Yanukovych government, Viktor Yanukovych, his not wanting to sign the EU association agreement, not immediately and probably not in the near future, without some type of financial assistance that would help Ukraine ameliorate the effects of the neoliberal shock therapy. And that's essentially what the EU association agreement was. In economic terms, it was a neoliberal shock therapy, 1,500 pages long. So this was ostensibly the reason for the protests against the government, although certainly I would not argue that the government of Viktor Yanukovych was corrupt, and that was another primary reason. The pro-Western Orange Revolution government before that was corrupt. The government before that was corrupt. The government now is corrupt. In fact, polls show that a slight majority actually feel it's more corrupt than the last government, and most likely the next government of Ukraine is corrupt. So I think we can probably dismiss that as a reason for overthrowing the government violently outside of legal or constitutional processes. But a large number of people on the Maidan during the protests were also ultra-nationalists, and some, I think it's a pretty fair characterization to call people like Right Sector and Azov, fascists, neo-Nazis, people who worship, Stefan Bandera and the genocidal West Ukrainian organizations from World War II, the OUN and the UPA. The Ukrainian Insurgent Army, that were collaborators with Hitler and were responsible for the Holocaust in Ukraine against Jews, Poles, and no small number, of course, of their own citizens.
Can you tell us a bit about Stefan Bandera? We hear his name, but what did he do? Who was this guy that these, because I've seen some of these Right Sector people, Azov Battalion people, actually have pictures of him still on their walls, don't they?
Oh, I mean, far be it from that. During the Maidan, during the protests, when they occupied city hall, before they toppled the rest of the government, about a month in, when they occupied the city hall, they hung a simply giant banner of Stefan Bandera from the ceiling. Stefan Bandera, during World War II, he was a West Ukrainian, perhaps the term, he never really considered himself Ukrainian, he considered himself Galician, because West Ukraine had only recently become part of the Soviet Union and the Ukraine at that time. Previously, it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth before that. He was basically West Ukraine's own version of fascism. He was a lifelong collaborator with Hitler. They welcomed the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union, fought alongside them, helped corral the citizens, the Jews, the Poles, the people they committed a massacre against. In fact, we know from Nazi letters documentation that they actually were a little horrified because they regarded these West Ukrainian fascists as bloodier than they were in the amount of massacres and the sheer brutality involved with what they were doing in West Ukraine.
The other thing, Mark, is that you know, I've seen certainly reports, and maybe you can corroborate this or not, that in Ukraine over the last decade or so, they've still been these sort of public celebrations of Bandera and the pro-Nazi groups, the far-right ultra-nationalist groups in Ukraine. Is that true?
Oh, of course it is. Well, first of all, during the Maidan, you know, you can check mainstream Western media reports for this. There was 15,000 people who marched on January 1st of 2014 in a torchlit ceremony at night, honoring the birth of Stefan Bandera. But it goes far more than that, because the regime that has come to power in Ukraine, the U.S. and EU-backed government that, you know, that seized power just a couple months after that, they have openly declared in law that these organizations that Bandera headed and was a part in, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army and their political wing, are the founding fathers of the state of Ukraine now, and that they are national heroes. And a step further, anyone who says otherwise can be imprisoned under law. And that would, of course, include any historians who happen to show up in Ukraine for research and say, hello, these were genocidal maniacs who collaborated with Hitler. They weren't national heroes. They shouldn't be your national heroes. This has received very scant attention in the Western press, who want to paint a very different perception of what this government is, who its leaders are, and who are these paramilitary battalions that fight for it,
but
and
Mark,
what they believe in.
But Mark, isn't there some sort of, I mean, surely there must be some kind of law guidance or whatever with regard to the Pentagon and the EU funding, that money shouldn't be going to neo-Nazi, neo-fascist groups like the Azov Battalion, who are a kind of fascist, well, they are not a kind of, they are a fascist fighting group that are neo-Nazis. So surely we can't be funding them.
Well, Azov and right sector, of course, only the most egregious and popular, the most publicized. Many of these battalions, you know, accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity by Human Rights Watch and others, they are really just as guilty. Certainly the so-called liberal or neoliberal government, which sends them to subjugate the parts of Ukraine that still resist their seizure of power. How can we not call them far right or fascist themselves if they're willing to knowingly use these people? But there was some attention drawn in the U.S. Congress, and the quite storied black congressman John Conyers, almost a year and a half ago now, put amendment into a Pentagon defense spending bill that was allocating money and weapons to prop up this regime, that specifically outlined that at least none of the funding should go directly to Azov Battalion, which is perhaps the most notorious and most openly neo-fascist of this regime's paramilitary organizations. Just in the last 2 weeks, at the Pentagon's insistence, this bill was dropped from the new U.S. defense spending bill. So now the U.S. government is free to directly arm a neo-Nazi paramilitary battalion serving the new government of Ukraine.
Now,
and,
we've
Azov's neo-Nazi credentials are really something that even the most whitewashing of the Western press hasn't been able to deny.
Can you give us a couple of examples of what Azov have been up to then? Because I know there's still a modicum of democracy in eastern, particularly northeastern Ukraine. Obviously, some people will be voting for regimes, for mayors, etc., who aren't necessarily pro the Kiev government.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen a whole host of political and military actions. Of course, most egregious actions, Azov in particular, was against the citizens of Donbass. They have been accused of various things by international organizations, you know, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. But of course, because the Ukrainian government, you know, has no desire to investigate them, we haven't seen anything proven. It's certainly not in any type of international context. But right now, they occupy the city of Mariupol, which, at the right after the Maidan putsch, along with the rest of the Donbass, voted overwhelmingly, as even Western journalists were forced to admit at the time, the number of people turning out in the streets, to distance themselves, to seek some form of autonomy or independence from this new government that seized power, that they rejected. We know that the Azov has, for instance, there have been reports by an anti-Putin reporter, Anna Nemtsova, in Foreign Policy, that Azov battalion sitting in Mariupol is openly working with fighters, foreign fighters from Syria that were veterans of ISIS. All right, and this isn't coming from the Russian government. This is coming from a anti-Russian reporter that in Foreign Policy.
Let's just skip back to Odessa. What happened there in a nutshell, and what do we now know about it?
Yeah, okay, so this is one of the particular incidents that members of Azov and members also of Right Sector and other groups were involved in. In May 2nd of 2014, Odessa, which is a majority, you could say Russian ethnic city or Russian speaking. I don't like to speak in those terms because they aren't exactly accurate. I would say more they have a conception of Ukrainian national identity, which is, shall we say, either pro-Russian or at least not anti-Russian. Okay, like the Ukrainian national identity in West Ukraine is very anti-Russian. That's why, the civil war has broken down largely on West-East lines. It's a competition of national identity. Well, there were clashes in the city of Odessa between supporters of the new Maidan government and those who opposed it. We can call them anti-Maidan, perhaps most accurately. There were opposing rallies, and there were fights that resulted from this, as there were in many cities around eastern Ukraine at this point. I mean, we saw very similar things in Kharkov, Dnipropetrovsk, all over Donbass, and also in Odessa. But what made Odessa singularly different is that in Odessa, and it seems there was a great deal of planning involved in this, that there was an attempt to try to shock the people of Odessa who resisted the new government into inaction. They drove somewhere between 50 and 100 pro-Russian protesters, activists, into a building, a trade union building, and then they tossed Molotov cocktails into the building, igniting it. And as somewhere at least 49 people, probably more, died in the blaze, or it seems, although the medical reports, they're still refusing to release these, 2 years later, and certainly no one has been tried or found guilty or no blame, no cause of the incident has officially been determined. Which even the EU has protested against. But it seems that some of the people probably died from bludgeoning, beating, and being shot as they tried to escape the building. And in East Ukraine and Russia, this is known as the Odessa Massacre. And along with not determination of any guilt or any type of real investigation into this, we still don't actually know what happened on the Maidan when 80-some people, including 24 police, were killed on the day of the Maidan putsch, or the day before on February 21st, 2014. 2 years later, and this new government still hasn't determined who was responsible for that or made anyone responsible under law. And I think this is obviously a failure of the justice system of this new government.
Now, there's a big conflab in the Donbass, which is the southeast of Ukraine, which has ended up with it being actually becoming a kind of autonomous republic, self-governing, and there was a lot of fighting down there until the Minsk Agreement. Tell us how maybe if you can, a bit about the history of where this word Donbass comes from, and then whether this Minsk Agreement is holding, how effective it's being.
Okay, the Donbass. These are the regions of Lugansk and Donetsk in southeast Ukraine. They are the regions other than the Crimea, which has since separated from Ukraine and reunified with Russia from a referendum. My wife being one of the people who quite gladly voted and her family voted for that escape from the madhouse that Ukraine has become. But the people of Donbass, the Donbass is kind of the working, the most industrialized working area of Ukraine. They had not only a pro-Russian, but I would say even a pro-Soviet identity there. A lot of miners, a lot of factory workers. It was the heart of Ukraine's export economy, by far the majority of the exports of Ukraine before this whole conflict started came from the Donbass. And it was probably a little dated in modern terms. There hadn't been any a true modernization since Ukraine's independence from the USSR in 92. They still generated revenue and jobs, and it was one of the wealthiest areas of the Ukraine, probably the second wealthiest after Kiev itself. So when they, as most of the South and the East, opposed the forces that seized power during the Maidan, they organized referendums, they organized self-defense militias, the people turned out in the streets take their local government buildings over, as the Maidan had done in Kiev, and they originally met the first trickle of Ukrainian troops and paramilitary that came to finish the Maidan revolution, as they call it, and take Donbass as well. They met these tanks and APCs with bare hands and disarmed the troops peacefully at first until these troops loyal to the new government, mostly paramilitary, then hung back and started shelling their cities with artillery and the like. So the people there, they organized a referendum to try and get some type of autonomy or independence. The wording was a little vague at the time. And I don't think there's any question that they have received support from the Russian government, both financial and probably military. I wouldn't be surprised. I'm pretty sure military advisors, military intelligence were involved as well, although it has of course been noted that the West has pumped tens of billions of dollars through their own states, through the IMF, to prop up the new government in Kiev and armed and trained its forces to kill its own people into submission. As of now, some 9,500, close to actually, people, mostly from the Donbass, have been killed. And by far, the most of them were killed by a government that claims, to be their own.
But this has apparently been turned around by the Minsk Agreement. Give us in a nutshell what that was and tell us if you think it's holding.
Yeah. Okay. So the Minsk Agreement, there was two of them, and we're referring to Minsk II. The first one failed. The second one has pretty much frozen a conflict. It hasn't stopped the fighting, okay, but it has severely reduced it. It's to a fraction of what it once was, but every night the cities of Donbass towns are still shelled, by mortars, sometimes by artillery pieces and tanks that are brought up from where they are supposed to have been withdrawn But the Minsk Agreement was an agreement between the people of Donbass, these Donetsk and Lugansk republics, the Ukrainian government in Kiev, the regime there. And then there were guarantors of this were France, Germany, and Russia. And the agreement was to be overseen by the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And like I said, this has severely reduced the fighting there. And that's a good thing because, you know, we now have a trickle of deaths rather than, you know, hundreds weekly. But, you know, it is a frozen conflict, and we haven't seen the success of the Minsk agreements beyond this immediate partial cessation of hostilities, you know, this ceasefire. The Minsk agreement also calls for a large number of political compromises, mostly that fall to the Ukrainian government, that it has to make in order to reintegrate the Donbas with a degree of decentralization back into the Ukraine. A lot of people don't understand this, you know, because of the hysteria of the Western press. But Russia, the you know, shall we speak of the Russian government, the Kremlin doesn't want Donbas. It doesn't want it. You can't get them to take it. I think that the West and the, you know, the Ukrainian government in Kiev would very much like Russia to take the Donbas from them, so they don't have to deal with its people who don't like it in the slightest. But Russia doesn't want the Donbas because at this point there's so much devastation of the area. Whoever wins the Donbas loses economically because they have to rebuild it. The new Ukrainian government would have to somehow reintegrate its people into the political process. And now that they have a degree of self-organization and defense, they might have to debate these people on open terms. And, you know, the truth of what has happened there the last 2 years might come out. So Russia doesn't want the Donbas, even though many of the people in the Donbas would have liked to go to Russia. Others, you know, still want to remain part of Ukraine, but they don't want the regime in Kiev in power. They would like to see it removed. The Minsk agreements, the Minsk II, is supposed to see elections that bring the Donbas back into Ukraine, local elections, but these are only supposed to take place after constitutional changes in Kiev. That would give decentralization and some degree of, I think autonomy is too large a word, but some local powers devolved to this region to help it protect the people's theirs basic rights, their identity, their language, and their political rights. But none of these have been met. In fact, when Kiev made the first reading in the Rada of a bill to start instituting this decentralization, there were riots consisting of ultra-nationalist paramilitaries and parties in Kiev, and we saw members of the National Guard killing each other on the streets of Kiev with thrown grenade and handguns. So the regime in Kiev is really in a tough place. It can't win the conflict in Donbas militarily, one, because of the degree of organization in Donbas, two, because they are supported by Russia, and Russia will probably provide them whatever they need not to be conquered or reintegrated by military force. They want there to be a political compromise. But at the same time, they have their own political base. These paramilitary battalions who have been fighting for it, both on the Maidan and since, they are furious at the idea of any type of political compromise and want to see this the people in this area squashed militarily and reintegrated by military force and reject any type of compromise, which, you know, what they regard as pro-Russian separatists.
Well, look, back to 2014 again, and one of the big events of many people will remember to do with the whole Ukraine conflict is the controversial shooting down, whether it's by a missile or what, no one seems to really be sure about, of this Malaysian airliner on its way from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, which was overflying Ukraine. What's come out since? And I think we've got a pretty strong view here in the West from the news reports that this was something which was done by the separatists with a bit of help from the Russians, perhaps. But what's been trickling out over on the other side from the East and from Russia? Yeah. What's their view of what happened with this airliner, and what evidence have they got?
Okay, well, I think first, to really get the context of when this airline was shot down, you have to first understand what was happening at the time. Ukraine, which was slowly, the government in Ukraine in Kiev, which was slowly gaining control of their of the Ukraine's military at that point. They had to purge the military ranks of people who weren't loyal to the new government, so it took them some time. But they were sending military aircraft, fighter jets, to launch airstrikes against their own cities, the cities of Donbass. They were firing missiles from these fighters, as they were also firing even ballistic missiles, separately launched at the cities of Donbass. And so the people there, they managed to seize the anti-aircraft equipment that the Ukraine had in the area, and some additional was probably provided by Russia, and they were trying to shoot down these aircraft as they were bombing their cities. All of the anti-aircraft that had been used was against something quite low-flying military planes, nothing that anywhere approached the height, nearly 10,000 feet of what MH17 passenger airlines fly at. And there were lots of other planes that had overflown this area before, including on the day through this area, and nothing was ever shot down. In fact, there still remains a question of whether the people of Donbass, the militias there, actually had any anti-aircraft that had the capability to reach that high and shoot down a civilian plane, never mind why they would do this. I think everyone, the going argument is at least that it was an accident, that they might have assumed it was a Ukrainian warplane coming to bomb their cities or bring troops in. That's not something that's really addressed, because it takes away, from the whole separatist guilt narrative. The Dutch Safety Board, which has made itself kind of the investigator, judge, and jury for this, which is a little bit unusual, because the largest number of people killed on this passenger plane, by whoever did it, were Dutch citizens, followed by some other countries, Australia and Malaysia and so on. But it's a little bit fishy to me that the victim would be allowed to conduct the investigation and judge the results. I'm not quite sure, because I thought there was supposed to be some kind of separation of justice involved, where, the country that is the victim probably shouldn't be conducting the investigation and then determining, guilt as such. But the Dutch Safety Board has released a report arguing that a Soviet designed anti-aircraft system known as a Buk, which is a very complex and multi-unit piece of military equipment, was used to shoot down the MH17. There have been some arguments. I think the weight of the evidence does suggest that was probably the cause, but there has been no determination, officially at least, of whether it was the Ukrainian government, which did have multiple, many of such devices in the area, or whether it was the militias, whether they managed to get a hold of one of the Ukrainian military's Buk systems, or some accuse that Russia transferred them one, and that it then was secretly withdrawn right after it was used once to shoot down this passenger plane. I find this narrative a little funny, and I find the a lot of the evidence that has been presented to be coincidental at best. And Russia has issued its own reports from the manufacturers of the system. They're now making arguments about which exactly type of missile might have been used, which might indicate whether it was a Russian-sourced missile or whether it was from Ukraine's own military supplies. You know, I don't think anyone argues that this was a tragedy and innocent people were killed. But what isn't really taken into account is that this was a war zone, and the Ukrainian government was at that time sending military planes to bomb cities full of its own people. And that's, you know, we can appreciate the, you know, and grieve for the victims of this plane, but no one in the West is grieving for the people in Donbass who were being killed. And although at a much smaller rate, still are being killed by a government, you know, that seized power undemocratically, that you know, the West openly supports, props up with money, arms, training, military advisors, and so on. And I believe that this government is not a fair and representative government.
Mark, what's your prediction for Ukraine? Because surely, I mean, as you said, Minsk, the fighting has been frozen. It's not over. And there are also, there's a lot of people in the east of Ukraine. I mean, you mentioned, I think, was it Mariupol, but other places like Kharkov, for example, many people around there are not happy with the Kiev regime. And I just wonder, because, I mean, they're very close to the Russian border, what you think is going to be the future for this country over the next few years?
Yeah, we know from... the elections, such as if they have been taken place, and it must be noted that elections held by this new regime in Ukraine, I don't think can be considered anywhere fair and democratic, as all of the political parties that represented the people of East Ukraine have been banned or lustrated and persecuted since it took power in 2014. So when we say elections in Ukraine, I believe we have to say it with quotes, with a grain of salt. How can you have fair elections when three leftist parties and the majority party of the former government, which was democratically elected according to the EU, aren't allowed to participate? We know from the elections that the people of East Ukraine continue to reject the political parties that constitute the new government. We know from the polling that they continue, as the majority do now in Ukraine, to disapprove of this government. The president has approval ratings at you know, this oligarch Poroshenko, their president, has approval ratings at 17%. The government, the prime minister, have approval ratings in single digits. The people in Ukraine are dissatisfied and disapprove of this government by far. Certainly that goes double for the people of South and East Ukraine and the Donbass. And when you take a look at the poll numbers, and these are done by Western polling agencies, you see that primarily the East-West divide of Ukrainian identity still exists. It hasn't changed at all. It's, if anything, has been heightened. So I don't have a lot of hope, actually, for this conflict. I think we have to enjoy the conflict being frozen. As I've said before, for domestic political reasons, I don't believe the new regime can or intends to fulfill the Minsk agreements. It has already been, in the recent weeks, been making a lot of noise, saying they can't possibly do it, asking the EU to help them, you know, withdraw from it, and craft a Minsk III that is more to their liking, that would require them to make less compromises and constitutional changes to reintegrate the Donbass. You know, they haven't made a lot of headway on that. And if they withdraw from the Minsk unilaterally at some point, or resume hostilities themselves, you know, then of course the whole deal will collapse and the whole region might revert to full-scale warfare. Russia is certainly doing everything they can to avoid such a thing. They're also involved in Syria now, so they don't want a resumption of hostilities. Certainly the people in Donbass don't want a resumption of hostilities, but neither do they want to be unprotected with this, government that they, completely politically and identity-wise reject. So I think chances are likely that at some point the new government, facing such horrible discontent, the collapse of the economy, will see a resumption of military hostilities, against their own people, as the least bad of all the alternatives, and that might help bolster them domestically, at least among their ultra-nationalist base. I'm sorry to be pessimistic with that.
That's all right. No.
And like I said, I do have family in the Donbass, and of course their safety, And we, well, God knows we don't want to see it extend, this conflict, not only reignite, but risk extending to the rest of South and East Ukraine as well.
Okay, maybe just one real final question. If the hostilities do erupt again in Eastern Ukraine, as they may, what do you see, being the sort of actual natural border between those who are maybe more pro-Russian and would like their own republics in the East, and those who are more pro-Kiev? Is there a sort of dividing line which you think maybe in the future the nation may settle out into two different sectors?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing we would see a mass movement of people once again. There are already somewhere between 1 and 2 million people from the Donbass who have fled. They are refugees living in Russia, the one that the Western press calls the aggressor, who is sending troops to occupy them. None of this is really true in any type of serious military scale. But the people were being attacked and they were dying, and a lot of them fled. When I was at the London School of Economics doing model UN crisis scenarios, I actually ran a war game scenario that predicted this, that predicted a civil war in the Ukraine along east-west lines. And this was back in 2010. Some 4 years before this. Now, I predicted it during a contested election instead of a disagreement over trade and an association with the EU. But we have indeed seen East-West civil war. Certainly, at the very least, any type of natural borders that might result from a resumption of hostilities would at least be the republics of Donetsk and Lugansk, these regions of Ukraine. But, there is also very strong anti-government settlement in much of East Ukraine. I predicted that eventually a border would be drawn along the Dnieper. The one city that is perhaps most problematic with this assessment is Dnipropetrovsk, which is probably close to 50-50 between preferring, if not the exact makeup of this current government, but preferring a Maidan government or rejecting the Maidan government. We always say pro-Russian mentality. That city could see some real bloodshed and division. I think elsewhere, you might see some natural division along the Dnieper River. But I think we all hope that it doesn't come to that.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Nick Outerside. I've been a newspaper and magazine journalist for about 30 years now. And I cut my teeth very early on, initially in glossy magazines, but then I moved into what I now probably now call proper journalism, which was newspapers. I took up my first editorship in a small town called Lochilped on the west coast of Scotland in Argyll in late 1990, and was pretty well feeling my way. I was still a young man, and I suppose as far as journalism went, the world was still my oyster. I'd had some life experiences beforehand in magazines and before that as a teacher, and obviously things that my parents had told me and so forth. I was aware at that point of what Freemasonry was. I'd read Philip Knightley's book, The Brotherhood, and a few other books about it. And I know that my father particularly had warned me. He'd been invited to become a member of a lodge some years earlier. And he explained to me some of the connections that Freemasons made, particularly within planning authorities, within the police, and within local councils. Indeed, my brother-in-law at the time was a police sergeant in Sussex, and he told me that he would never progress beyond inspector unless he joined the lodge. I think his words were, "I need to stand on the square to get on in this job." So I bring you up to date then to 1991. I'd been in post as editor of the Argyllshire Advertiser for about 4 months. And by chance, one day I met a guy called Bill Hodgson. Bill was a former farmer and wine importer and was the Conservative Party candidate for Argyll and Bute. He'd been selected about 15 months earlier. He came into my office, introduced himself. I was not a Tory. Indeed, my politics were quite left of Bill. But he and his wife, Elan, made themselves known and welcome. And I have to admit that they were gregarious, self-effacing, and above all, they appeared honest. They were nice people, really nice people. After the initial meeting with the Hodgsons, I became aware that Bill had a reputation already in Argyll of being something of a maverick, a bit of a go-getting politician, not afraid to speak his mind. But that said, Bill has a success story behind him. In 1979, for instance, he achieved the largest Conservative swing in Scotland in the safe Labour seat of East Kilbride. 8 years later, in 1987, he came within 900 votes of ousting the Labour in Carlisle. So he was well placed to take what was a Tory Lib Dem marginal in Argyll and Bute. I quickly found out that within 2 months of his selection as the Tory party candidate, Bill became involved in a bitter row with one of Argyll's biggest landowners, a guy called Douglas Campbell. He owned vast tracts of the Cowell Peninsula in Argyll. He'd flouted planning orders and felled a forest of trees in order to build himself 40 luxury holiday chalets. In his local paper, the Dunoon Observer, Bill went on the offensive and he called the felling of the trees the misconduct of a barbaric Philistine. Wonderful words, but words which would come back to haunt him later. Mr. Campbell was one of 13 applicants who stood against Bill for the Conservative nomination for Argyll. He was also, as I found out much later, a prominent Freemason and close friend of Ian Campbell, no relation, the 12th Duke of Argyll, first cousin to the Queen and a master Freemason in Scotland. Just before my own arrival in Argyll, Bill had also fallen out with one or two of the Conservative Party's own constituency executives, including a guy called Noel Fachenda, who was also by chance a Freemason. He'd already ruffled the feathers of some prominent Tories, and I was aware that there was a shadowy sort of campaign amongst some people to get rid of Bill. On the 25th of May 1991, the simmering row broke into open warfare with resignation of the constituency chairwoman, a close friend of Douglas Campbell by chance, a woman called Margaret Forrest, who claimed she'd been subjected to verbal assaults from Mr. Hodgson. Mr. Hodgson defended himself by saying he was simply pointing out incompetence within the local party. At this point, I became probably quite friendly with Bill. He became a confidant, and he began briefing me about the shenanigans and moves to unseat him by some of his own party officials. This was despite the fact that among party members in Argyll and voters at large, don't forget I was the newspaper editor, I hopefully think I was in touch, Bill was being seen as popular and electable, a Tory closer to the people than to the landowners who dominated the power plays in Argyll. The year rolled on, then something happened. On the 16th of August, Bill suffered a minor heart attack. He was quickly assured by his doctors that a simple heart bypass operation would ensure a return to perfect health. But while he was waiting for that operation, I began to hear rumours that certain people within the party were going to try and use his own ill health as a way of getting rid of him. Indeed, I was very, very friendly. In fact, I shared the same building with his Labour opponent, Des Brown, the same Des Brown who went on to become Secretary of State for Scotland in the Labour government. And he went on record saying, Bill Hodgson won't last long. His own party are out to get him. A bit later, at a small dinner party, Bill told me he'd had enough and needed to fight back. On the 9th of September, this is some 5 months after this all began, the rumours of a coup against him began to harden. Bill told 40 supporters at a meeting in Campbelltown, which is right at the southern end of this vast rural constituency, that there was a definite plot to oust him. He said openly the perpetrators were using his ill health as a smokescreen. He quoted, "There has been an energetic commitment to apathy, disloyalty, and the worship of incompetence." Bill knew he was pouring oil onto a smouldering fire. The very next day, the constituency executive called an emergency meeting. Campbelltown councillor Archie McCallum, who was also chairman of the district council and another prominent Freemason, denied there was any plot to oust Bill, saying publicly we're only interested in his health. But things were about to change. On the 23rd of September, 3 days after Bill's heart bypass operation in Glasgow, the local party executive held an emergency meeting to discuss his future. The Duke of Argyll, Ian Campbell, prompted by Douglas Campbell, proposed a motion calling for Bill's immediate resignation. Don't forget, this was while Bill was still in hospital recovering from a heart bypass. The vote was passed by 27-17, despite the fact that many members who were entitled to vote were given such late notice that they couldn't make the meeting. Some of these members were 120 miles away on places like the Isle of Mull or the Isle of Jura or Oban. This was bizarre, to say the least. I rang Bill the next day, and from his hospital bed in Glasgow, he issued a press statement which he said, "What is really annoying me has been the sneaky, chicken-livered way in which plotters have behaved. Now they've been rumbled, they'll try and blame somebody else. I'm sure they'll now go on the attack." The local party was about to split down the middle. Within 24 hours, many of those present at the executive meeting were briefing against Bill to the local and the national press. The gloves were off and the fight was on. Bill was rarely off the phone to me with updates or advice, as it was here that he wanted... Sorry, I need to go back on that and try to edit that one out. Bill was rarely off the phone to me with updates or advice. And it was here, the very first time in my journalistic career, and it was repeated later, that I found out my telephone at home, my home phone, was being bugged and my calls to Bill were intercepted.
How did you know that, Nick?
In my career, my phone has been bugged on 4 or 5 occasions. But this was the first time. This was 1991. Technology was still quite underdeveloped by today's standards. I had an old-fashioned answer phone at home, a cassette-taped-based one, which would play my answer message to the caller. It would cut off if I picked up the call. So it would cut off mid-sentence, mid-word. But if one of the two phones in the house had been lifted, the answer phone would cut off. Over a period of about 10 days at this time, 4 calls cut off within 30 seconds of my message being relayed. I found out afterwards, or later, that each time the call was cut off, it was Bill Hodgson that was ringing, which indicated either his phone or mine or both were certainly being tapped. Somebody was picking up the call that Bill was making and leaving his message. And that I found interesting because the message was still left, but the call was being cut off. I never found out by whom, but the machinations which later developed may give a few pointers. The first to show his colours was Archie McCallum, who put the blame wholly on Bill. And this probably is the key to the whole story. Mr. Callum, at a private meeting in late November that year, Lord Willie Whitelaw, former Conservative Party chairman and Home Secretary, and one of the most leading prominent Freemasons in England, had recommended the constituency, quote, ditch Bill Hodgson, claiming he'd run into problems in Carlisle in 1987. Of course, nothing was further from the truth. McCallum was coy about the meeting with Whitelaw, refused to ever repeat the words used. But I later established the private meeting was at Inverary Castle, home of the Duke of Argyll, with the Duke and Douglas Campbell also present. The Masonic plot against Bill was almost complete, with a cousin of the Queen and former Tory Home Secretary at the hub. With the power broker stacked against him, Bill appeared before the constituency executive on the 7th of December. He was voted down by 36 votes to 33, and his resignation demanded forthwith. He then sought a meeting with Conservative Party Chairman Lord Sanderson, another prominent Freemason, and called for a private postal, but secret postal ballot of all members in the constituency. He refused to resign. He had public opinion with him. 2 weeks later, just before Christmas of 1991, over 200 party members signed a petition demanding a general meeting to discuss Bill's candidacy. And it was clear they would win and Bill would be instated or reinstated as the candidate. But always expect the unexpected. Less than 24 hours after the demand for the meeting was tabled, with orders from central office, the Scottish Conservative Association stepped in and dissolved the entire constituency association in Argyll. Thus, they deselected Bill as priority candidate and excommunicated hundreds of Tory party members in one blow. People were outraged, but one executive member added, Bill's future was decided by a cabal of powerful people within our party. The one thing that unites them, other than being Conservatives, is they all belong to one secret society.
You keep talking there about such and such was a Freemason, this guy was a Freemason. Yeah. I mean, you know, for many journalists, they'll, you know, you've got to have evidence for that. You've got to have proof for it. In a secret society, Masons are not open, are they, about who they are?
I agree with you, Tony. It's very easy, actually, to find out whom. By ordinary Freemasons, it's probably very difficult, unless you actually stake out their meetings to find out who are Masons. But office holders, it's very easy. The Scottish Freemasonry release a Freemasonry handbook every year. It's a green 200-page tome, and it lists all their office holders for each lodge. And it's very easy, therefore, as a journalist, even back then, without the power of the internet, to find out who the real Freemasons were. The big men, the office holders. I mean, for instance, and I don't know the terms that are used, but the Duke of Argyll, the 12th Duke of Argyll, Ian Campbell, was the Grand Cyclops, or whatever the term is. He was the head Freemason in Scotland. Willie Whitelaw also held a very, very prominent Freemasonry position in England. And it was very easy then to find out, for instance, that Archie McCallum was a Grand Master at the local lodge in Campbelltown. Noel Fachendo held a similar position at the lodge in Lochilped. And the other people I've mentioned already also held office positions. These were office bearers. These were people who were deep in, up to their knees in Freemasonry. These weren't your average planning officer or something who went along to the odd meeting.
Up to their bare knees.
Their bare knees. I've got to use that. I was trying to get the rolled up trouser leg in there.
Anyway, what did this whole episode teach you about Freemasonry and its role, particularly in the Conservative Party?
I think it taught me that that the Conservative Party was wholly corrupt within Scotland at that time. I know it's changed dramatically in the last 25 years, but at that time it was up to its knees, and it really was. The Freemasonry angle, I had hints of it then. And I know Bill and his wife, Elin, both suggested it, but it was very difficult to prove at that time. It was probably about, this is 1991, so I'm talking about probably 6 years later, 1997, that I eventually managed to get hold of the Masonic handbooks. I got hold of six of them for the previous 6 years and was able to ascertain for myself then that these people really were prominent members of Freemasonry in Scotland.
But, I mean, it almost seems that Masonry is being used there to make big changes to who it is and who does and doesn't represent us in public life.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the key to this is that Douglas Campbell was a very, very powerful and very rich man. And he was intending to build a business empire in Cowell. What I found ironic is when he died in May last year, his obituary said, Douglas was one of the most innovative farmers of his generation who diversified into tourism, holiday parks and leisure facilities. He and his family built up a considerable business from his base in Loch Oilhead with hotels, shops and 8 holiday parks. And I think what happened, Bill by chance got in his way of building the empire. And all Douglas had to do was probably nudge one of his close friends, the Duke of Argyle, and set the wheels in motion to get rid of Bill. There are probably other reasons as well, but it was very clear that they just called in favours.
And what advice have you got for journalists and anyone really that's looking into Freemasonry as a possible cause? Because, I mean, for example, we've had recently here down in Weston-super-Mare, a Conservative mayor who was shown to have much, I think it was 120 films of child pornography. He was a master of his local lodge. And there certainly does seem to be some connection with Freemasonry. So what advice would you have about how you make decisions about facts and certainty? Because the whole way that Freemasons seem to operate is that they love this idea that no one quite knows who they are.
Yeah, and I take that. I think for the ordinary members of Masonic lodges, I mean, my former father-in-law was a Mason. In fact, my uncle was a Mason. I think for many of them, it is a social and charitable cause. But it can be used, and it's been proved many times over the years that certainly within the judiciary, with lawyers, police, very often favours are made. It's done within planning, for instance. As for advice for journalists, if you're given a tip-off that maybe there is Freemasonry, well, look into it. It's far easier now with the internet to actually cross and double-check certain facts about people you're unsure about. I mean, Willie Whitelaw, who I mentioned in my piece, this is 25, 26 years ago, he's only recently been investigated by the police now over VIP pedo rings in London. The Metropolitan Police are still investigating this, that he was involved with a gang accused of abusing 40 children, the youngest of whom was 6. So if that is true, this is possibly why, Tony, that the inquiries into the VIP pedo rings are being so hard to progress. If people do have these secret clubs in which they help each other, it's a big nut to crack.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Right, well, I'm joined now by Kevin Boylan. Kevin is a local lad, aren't you, Kevin? And you've picked up on this cabinet executive summary from the 3rd of November 2015, looking at a property fund to support homelessness. Now, I noticed around about November time, the mayor, George Ferguson, was on the telly on Points West saying something must be done about homelessness. So you've done a report on this, haven't you?
That's right. I've got what I did was I've accessed a executive summary of agenda item 7, which is actually available on the council website. It's not a secreted document as such, but it hasn't got much attention. And basically on November the 3rd, 2015, the mayor of Bristol approved investment of 5 million of Bristol City Council money into a local homeless property fund run by Real Lettings. This is an association of St. Mungo's Broadway homeless charity and Resonance Asset Management Company. The decision was rushed through Mayor Ferguson's cabinet without prior council consultation in order to beat any other council to the post. The pot of gold here was a matching offer of 15 million in speculation capital by Big Society Capital, the Tories' social investment scheme from 2010. I found out that it was formerly a pilot run by New Labour from 2000, known as the Social Investment Task Force. Anyway, the money, the 15 million, would go to the first three councils that are to invest in the scheme. As Oxford had already got there first, Ferguson wanted to get Bristol in second, and therefore, obviously, he couldn't wait for council approval. This means that Real Lettings Property Fund will receive approximately 10 million, half from BCC, half from BSC.
What do the two stand for?
BCC is Bristol City Council, and BSC is Big Society Capital. They will purchase properties to this value and expect to house 70 to 80 households in them on a ratio of 80% to families and 20% to singles, generally as a resource for the low end of homeless support needs, meaning not people who are have got very little hope. So it's basically people who are considered to be the cream of the homeless, as it were. And together,
what do you mean by the cream of the homeless?
Well, it's a term which they have themselves. They call it the unintentionally homeless. Is one of the words.
But what to give us an idea of what kind of people we're talking about here?
Well, the type of people who will be going into the accommodation are people who have a good chance of getting on, or whom St. Mungo's, who will have and the council, who will have the council makes the decision. And St. Mungo's does all the practical work involved.
So effectively what you're saying is these are homeless people who do not have other issues such as mental health, maybe drug addiction, that might actually make it more difficult for them to pay the rent.
By and large, yes.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Together, Resonance Finance, which does the finance end of things, and St. Mungo's, which does the practical day-to-day support, will manage the fund. Bristol City Council retains full rights over who is housed and also demands that the rent charged complies with the local housing allowance rates. Properties are to meet the decent homes standard and be rent as assured shorthold tenancies. The scheme is based on a pilot in London that has been operating for over 2 years and that claims a high rate of success in the rehabilitation of the homeless. There are two online reports which you can read under Resonance's website. For its part, Bristol City Council believes that the scheme will be significantly lower than the current emergency accommodation provided by them, i.e. private B&B. Lots of marketing stroke governmental jargon abounds, such as homelessness pathways, which we've already talked about. Priority need is another one, and then we have unintentionally homeless. This last example seems in effect reminiscent of the Victorian phrase, the deserving poor, to my ear. There are many cost projections, risk management tables, and colourful graphs with subheadings such as sensitivity analysis, capital appreciation, and cash yield. The former homeless will be encouraged along their homelessness pathways until they are deemed by staff to be ready to move into the private sector. a process which involves getting them jobs, credit, etc. It is also hugely dependent on the availability of the sector in terms of rent prices. The scheme expects each tenant to be gone within 2 to 3 years. The problem is that with Bristol's overall homeless situation, this feels like placing a sticking plaster all over a ever-widening wound in the city's housing market. In the private sector, rent is increasing and the rights of private landlords are almost inviolate. The public sector has been static for decades, and the gap filler here of housing associations are increasingly acting more and more like the private sector. To justify itself, the language in the council document places heavy emphasis on a rate of return with an estimated 3% plus profit going back into Bristol City Council and an unspecified, I haven't got the figures yet, but presumably similar rate of return going into big society capital. A last resort scheme is mentioned in case profits fall beneath 0.4% and when investors can pull out. And although the report stresses that BCC will do everything possible to ensure that existing tenants are protected from such a calamity, it is rather vague as to how this will be accomplished. How can the homeless be bailed out? Of particular note in this regard is one paragraph that states, "The fund is an unregulated collective investment scheme for the purpose of financial services and Markets Act 2000, which means it is not afforded FCA protection."
Now, the FCA is the Financial Conduct Authority, isn't it? The so-called financial regulator. Lots of questions that have been thrown up there. Who are these? I mean, I know St Mungo's, they do care for the homeless in many big cities, several big cities in Britain, quite well known. But who are these Resonance Asset Management people and Resonance Finance? Who are they? Because they sound like, to me, like private businesses, which are, or limited companies or something, which the public, you know, the people who are paying their wages effectively may not know anything much about them. They're private.
Well, they are technically private, but they are what's known as social enterprises, meaning that they are actually based throughout the Southwest. There's one based in Cornwall. There's another one based, I think, in Wales. And there's one based in Bristol.
So if they were council-run...
And they're also in London.
If they were council-run, then the public would be allowed to go along to the meetings. Councillors would be able to scrutinise what they were doing. And I'm a little bit suspicious when the mayor is setting up something which is run from the private sector, because the scrutiny is not there.
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. I mean,
and they're talking about using this £10 million of public money to purchase property to the value of £10 million when actually the council has got a vast amount of property of its own. It doesn't need to be purchasing property in order to do this, surely.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is that I spoke to Carmel Brogan, who is the writer of the document. She's an officer in the council, and I said to her, well, she asked me what I thought could be done instead, and I said, well, why not some good old fashioned social housing plus a rent cap? And she said, well, she would take that on board. And she's going to get back to me apparently with these options have already been discussed.
How far down the road with this are we now? And this is reports from November. We're now January, the year after. So that's 3 months later. What's happened?
Well, it still hasn't been realised, as in a lot of these things. The money has been promised, but it still hasn't been. Apparently, they're still working out the details of it, whatever that might mean. but the money isn't there at the moment.
And at least something's being done, surely. This is actually a positive thing, £10 million being spent on helping to house the homeless in Bristol.
Well, you could say that.
Well, I'm going to ask you then what Carmel Brogan asked you, which is, what would you do?
Well, as I said, the first thing would be to instigate a lot more social housing schemes and also to introduce, I think, one of the most important things is a rent cap across the private sector.
Righto, Kevin, thank you. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Stephen Lyle. I come from Scotland, Glasgow, and I'm classed as a serial entrepreneur in Scotland. In 2012, I set up a few businesses. One was called Negotiate Now. The other was called Business Go Five. In the first year, I took on 18 unemployed, and my aim was to take on another 100 unemployed over the next 14 months. But unfortunately, the businesses I set up coincided with another business in Scotland, another business, Entrepreneurial Spark. Entrepreneurial Spark is like a hub, a hatchery, that's set up for small businesses, young entrepreneurs, and it helps to guide them through the process of becoming a business person. So it's kind of like a training hub, and it was set up by sirs and lords in Scotland. One was called Sir Tom Hunter, one was called Sir William Hawkey. Now, unfortunately, the businesses I had, we had a very high media presence. We sponsored the likes of John Higgins, a snooker player. But because we're taking on 100 unemployed, we were always in the newspapers, the radio, the TV all the time. And we had the exact same setup as Entrepreneurial Spark, because we didn't have 1,000 square feet of offices. And these offices were training hubs, again, for young businesses that basically didn't have the money to grow, and giving our services to them free of charge. Now, we didn't really know much about Entrepreneurial Spark, but what we've found out since is that they were being given money under the table by the likes of Glasgow City Council. They were given £450,000. They were given £1 million from John Swinney, who is one of the MPs in Scotland. And basically, with the high profile that we had and the high media attention, people were asking questions about them, basically saying, well, why is this entrepreneur getting all this money and grants when we already have the same company running? And we had the expertise, and we had kind of like a couple of international names and brands connected to us. So with me taking on 100 unemployed, there was large funding that was going behind it. It was £350,000 of funding going behind it from an association called Clyde Gateway. Now, Glasgow City Council, the last thing that they needed was my businesses surviving. So Glasgow City Council came to see us in 2012, and they said they were going to give us money to grow the business, because at that point we were actually putting in just under £100,000 of our own money for the acceleration and the growth behind what we're doing. So we signed the paperwork and we took everything on trust, because why wouldn't we not? And basically they pulled all the funding out from under our nose without telling us, and what actually happened was it made all our businesses fold. Now, it folded coincidentally just a week before Alex Salmond, who was the First Minister at that time, was actually making a statement about myself, because by this time I'd already spoken Harvard. Now, obviously when it folded, Alex Salmond couldn't make a statement he was going to make about us. And the sirs and lords that were against us, they knew if Alex Salmond had made that statement, the businesses were still surviving, we'd have got to the next level. Because at this point, I was fighting against the corruption within Scotland, within the councils, and the control that these sirs and lords have. And I keep saying sirs and lords, and then one's called Sir Tom Hunter, the other one's called Sir Lord William Hawkey. Sir Lord William Hawkey put in a lot of money into Glasgow City Council through the back door, and he donated £2.4 million to Labour. hence he was given his title to Lord William Hawking, and now he's one of the peers in the House of Lords. Once the businesses went down, I tried to resurrect the businesses, and all of a sudden my name was slandered all over Scotland by one person. Now this one person, I'd only met her twice, and basically she took out a campaign their own to make sure that my name never, they had to make sure it didn't resurface within Scotland. And she made accusations that somebody was phoning her late at night with a withheld number. So she started writing all over the business community that I was involved in Scotland that I was a serial stalker. I was stalking her. And my credibility, my name got ruined. And it got ruined that bad. I mean, she actually went against my family as well. We took reports into the police. The police ignored it. Now, Entrepreneurial Spark was founded by Jim Duffy. Jim Duffy was a sergeant in a police station for 27 years in Glasgow. And all of a sudden, my house, my family, we had the police all over us with false accusations and everything else. It led to 8 suicide attempts by myself. It sounds like I'm not very good at it, but I was just very, very lucky that none of them worked. I spent 3 months in Garda Naval Royal, which is a psychiatric unit with post-traumatic stress disorder. Now the trials are actually coming to fruition, and I mean, my name has been cleared. I've kind of, in 2014, I actually ran 28 marathons in a year. I ran it for a couple of purposes. I ran it for one, for the independence of Scotland. But the main reason I ran the 28 marathons was to get my head back together, because I knew it was the one thing that was going to kind of get my mind back in a working condition the way it used to be. So what I've been doing for the last 3 years is basically fighting against the corruption within Scotland, and hopefully now everything's coming to an end. My name will be clear, like it should, and I can go back to the footing that I was in. I mean, I've now started another campaign regarding independence, which is totally separate, but my profile is kind of rising again in Scotland, and I'm looking forward to the trial being finished, because I mean, everything was slander, was libel, there was nothing what was said about me that could be backed up. And I've been advised that this woman that made these statements and spent a long, long time campaigning against me was actually paid to ruin my name. And so that's kind of my story.
Your court case, what's it all about?
Well, the court case, Tony, is this woman's allegations that I was stalking her. And the stalking is all down to, she was coming up with alias emails on Twitter, on Facebook, that was meant to be me. She came up with that somebody was phoning her house 20 times a day with withheld number. For some reason, she thought it was me. And the court case went ahead a month ago, and the prosecutor official actually asked a question about, had this ever happened to her before she seemingly fell out with me? And she says, yeah. I mean, the judge actually kind of looked inquisitive, but she says, yeah, she's always had received funny phone calls.
So what do you put all this down to?
Well, I've been told that she was paid by Sir Lord William Hawking to make sure that my name was ruined within Scotland, because I mean, when somebody like the First Minister is going to make a quote about you, and he actually told my PR team at the time that the quote would be made, he'd be talking about me then during the work that I was doing within Scotland. These lords had to make, the people that run Entrepreneurial Spark had to make sure that I didn't come back.
But you were, hang on, when you were being quite successful, why couldn't they just allow you to carry on in that success?
Well, I found, obviously, Tony, when this kind of thing happens to you, you start digging. And because at first I couldn't really work it out myself. And 3 years down the line, I've done a lot of digging. There's a few members of Glasgow City Council who actually accused them of, what's the word, of corruption. They've actually been sacked since. Two have been sacked, and the two that I pointed the finger at. But like I said, I've done a lot of digging. They were getting a lot of money under the table. I mean, they were given like £450,000 that wasn't signed off by anybody, and it was challenged by a couple of councils in Glasgow City Council. And fair enough, they get sacked as well. So, Entrepreneurial Spark now, it's meant to be a hub that trains businesses in Scotland, and it doesn't take anything to do with successful businesses. But we found out since that for investing money into the successful businesses that are coming through. So in a sense, it's turned into a bit of a dragon's den. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, it does to a certain extent, but I'm still puzzled as to why they should pick on you. I mean, you were actually making a go of it all.
I was making a go of it, Tony. See, the company I set up, Business Growth Now, it's six specialists in it. One was from a guy from England who owned a business called Results Corporation at the time. He became a director. Another director was of a company called, I don't know if you've heard of them, Sandler Sales Training, the largest sales training organisation in the world. That was another director. One was from Google, from Silicon Valley, with a team of specialists that they couldn't match in Scotland. Now, there was questions getting asked. Why was this entrepreneurial spark being given money when they already had the same company in Scotland? So the only solution was to get rid of the company in Scotland. Because entrepreneurial spark now, they've got branches all over Europe now. It's not, and this was the first two hubs that they opened at the same time. And unfortunately for them, I was kind of a month ahead of them. But obviously, it was more unfortunate for me because, I mean, 8 suicide attempts later, my marriage ruined because of the pressure. And I had a wee 5-year-old boy at times, now 7.5, by late. I actually had to go on the run for a year. I was in England, I was in Scotland, I was in Ireland hiding from them. My houses were getting raided by the police. I handed myself into London police. London police phoned them up from Victoria Station, phoned Glasgow up and says that they've got Stephen Lyle here. Glasgow wouldn't tell them what it was for. They kept on saying it was high profile. And I'll tell you a crazy story, Tony, which has been investigated at the moment. When I was in Gartneville for 3 months, now 3 months with PTSD inside a psychiatric ward is a long, long time for anybody. And I tried to commit suicide. And obviously Gartneville Hospital had to inform the police. They brought me back in at 2 in the morning. At 12 o'clock the next morning, the police took me out of Gartneville. Now, it wasn't, they took me physically out. They actually phoned my psychiatrist that morning and told my psychiatrist they had to see me. It was very high profile and had serious warrants out for me. And the psychiatrist actually gave them leave. I mean, the psychiatrist let them in and he told the hospital staff to let the police in. I was taken to Berlin police prison that day, and believe it or not, it was for £250 fine. Now, my psychiatrist is actually one of my witnesses now because that case goes ahead next month on the 2nd of February. My psychiatrist is one of my witnesses now, telling him, and he's telling the courts that he was told by the police that it was high profile, it was a serious nature, there was serious warrants out from arrest. There was a £250 fine.
Now, there's been some big changes in the way the police operate in Scotland, haven't there, with the concentration of power into the hands of one sort of super chief constable. I wonder if you think that's had a bearing on what's happened to you.
It's got a huge bearing, because it's one division, the one force, and it was run by Sir Stephen House. I mean, Sir Stephen House now has actually resigned, and he's moving down and there's a new whoever coming in. Now, the corruption in the police force is rife, and I mean rife. I was actually in Fort Mill, and the police thought it was something, totally nothing to do with it. It was something that broke out in the town at the time. And it worked out that I had warrants against, which I hadn't. And they phoned the Glasgow police up to say, we've got Stephen Lyle here. The Glasgow police turned and pulled Fort William to let me go. They couldn't tell another police division what it was within Scotland, because they never had anything on me. They kept on producing. It sounds kind of crazy. It sounds kind of... But yeah, the police force in Scotland, the corruption through the police force is just... I mean, they should never have been allowed. One force dictating a whole country is just... It'll never work. And now they know it's not going to work.
Stephen, who is it that's after you and why, do you think, in a nutshell?
Who started it was Sir Lord William Hawke. Now, if anybody Googles Sir Lord William Hawke's name, you'll see corruption's been following his name for the last 14, 15 years. He was famous for going down Glasgow City Council from the 1st of December to 24th of December, handing out brown envelopes under the table. And there was a new motorway built in Scotland called the M74. And Sir Lord Wilma Hawke, his premise is about 1,000 square feet. He was moved from there because seemingly it coincided with the motorway. He was actually given a brand new £20 million building, and he paid £1 for it. And he sold some of his land for £15 million to Tesco's, and that was the same building he was given for £1. Now, Sir Lord William Hawke, he's got a bad name in Scotland, a bad reputation. And this is his baby. Entrepreneurial Spark was his baby. And he had to make sure that Entrepreneurial Spark was going to work, and I was in the way. And that's what it came down to. It was nothing personal on his side of his business, but it was personal to me. Because he knew enough for my life. He ruined my family's life. So Lord William Hawke. But the good thing is now, Tony, we have got a lot of hard-hitting evidence that obviously I never had in 2012. In 2012, people thought I was a conspiracy theorist. They thought I was nuts. But thank God a lot of evidence has come out since. And I know within the next couple of months that my name will be clear and it'll be these people that the magnifying glass will be under or above.
Give us an idea of a couple of the bits of evidence which you've come across since 2012 that have helped your case.
Well, I've had a senior council official that's told me that there was emails going around and all this was happening to me with other council officials. Half of them were on my side. They didn't want anything. They didn't want what was happening to me happen to me. And half were saying they had to get rid of my businesses because it was in the way. So the email evidence is there for me. Also, regards to the £450,000 that Sir Lord William Hawke was given, an entrepreneurial spark. People get sacked for that in Glasgow City Council because it was never signed off. It should never have been allowed. But because of the power these people have got, it was signed. It was given to them. That's come out in the wash since. And this is evidence, this is hard evidence. It will prove that I was in the wrong place at the wrong time while it was unjust money going under the table to make this entrepreneurial spark a success, which it is now. It's a huge success. It's got branches, like I say, all over Europe. It's worth a lot of money. You're talking hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds to these people. I was just in the way, Tony. I was in the way.
So has this story made a splash in the Herald and other more independent-minded Scottish newspapers?
No, because I was told by the Sun newspaper in 2013 in 2012 I was kind of the golden boy in Scotland. I mean, I was twice a week I was in the newspapers, I was on the radios and TV, I was in Daybreak, I was in all the different stations. But in 2013 I was told by the Sun newspaper that they're not allowed to talk about me. They actually, it was like they put a gag on me, because obviously I phone newspapers all the time trying to get my story out. And at first they were interested, then the report was going back a few years later, and one actually admitted to me that nobody can it's like I was gagged.
That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans, hopefully back on BCFM soon. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guest, political science lecturer at Moscow State University, Russia Today correspondent Mark Slebeda, Nick Outerside on a backstabbing Scottish Tory Masons, Kevin Boylan, talking about the homelessness strategy here in Bristol under Mayor Ferguson, and Stephen Lyle, victim of the Glasgow Council Mafia. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production and anyone can contribute. Contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So, till the same time next week, goodbye for now.